This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. Last week, we put out a special show hosted by The Guardian's Lois Beckett, devoted to how reporters should approach the alt-right and white supremacy in America. One of the voices in that show was Norwegian journalist Vegas Tenold, whose new book, Everything You Love Will Burn, chronicles his time covering the far right up close and personal for nearly a decade.
I'm the idiot who's been doing this for so long that I think at times they kind of forget who I am and what I'm doing there.
As a bonus this week, we wanted to play you a full version of his conversation with Lois, in which they discuss his history with the far right, the mistakes he sees journalists making, and his relationship with the co-founder of the racist Traditionalist Worker Party, Matthew Heimbach. Enjoy.
So how did you get in with all of these Nazis?
The whole thing started back in, I think it was late 2010. I was at Columbia Journalism School and I was looking for a piece to do as a project. And I heard rumors that there were skinheads in Brooklyn, in Greenpoint. And I started looking into that and I quickly found out that they'd all been gentrified out years ago. But I found all these neo-Nazi weird nationalist websites who all looked like they were from 1994, like Angel Fire, AOL kind of websites, which is a tendency of the far right to make god-awful websites. But after a while, I found a bunch of emails and I got on a bunch of forums and I just said, this is me, I'm a journalist and I'd like to talk to someone if at all possible. And it was just a wall of silence for months and months and months until one day an email drops into my inbox from a guy calling himself Duke Schneider and who said he's the lieutenant of the SS in Brooklyn, which I thought was bizarre to say the least. He agreed to meet with me and we met again and again and again and again under an overpass by Avenue U Station in Sheepshead Bay in Brooklyn. I would go there on the train, and then I'd come under this overpass, and he would be there, oftentimes in a trench coat. And Duke is a very rotund gentleman, and his trench coat was very ill-fitting. So he looked kind of ridiculous. But he seemed to think that he was always followed, so we would have to do all these very cloak and dagger, lose whoever was following kind of thing. And so we would get in his Hyundai, and then we would just crisscross Sheepshead Bay a bunch of times and always end up in a diner two blocks away.
The same diner.
The same diner every time, El Greco diner. It's not there anymore. So I just put in a lot of time hanging out, talking, trying to explain what I was interested in. And then eventually I got invited to their convention. This was in Trenton, New Jersey. And it just kind of snowballed until I'd been doing it for 7 or 8 years.
How did you introduce yourself? How did you explain who you were beyond just saying I'm a reporter?
I always make a point of saying that I'm their enemy in the sense that I'm a Norwegian socialist.
You would sort of, in a funny way, flag that you didn't share their beliefs.
Yeah. And that allowed me to fight with them and argue with them and push back because they know that I disagreed. And then I think they were kind of taken aback by, okay, this guy doesn't share a single one of our opinions, but we can still kind of talk a little bit.
I mean, one thing that we have to say that radio listeners won't know is, like, you are a white guy from Norway with a shaved head.
Yes. I've often joked that my biography is going to be called, you know, Bald at a Skinhead Rally. The first time I went to Trenton, I remember everyone was sitting in this AA hall in Pemberton, New Jersey. I was kind of by the door with my notepad and my camera. And then all of a sudden, this guy called Gunner, he just comes bursting through the door and he starts screaming like, attack, Reds! And they were under attack. And I was right by the door. So I was out the door first and I see all these masked Antifa type people. And they see a bald man coming out of a neo-Nazi rally and one of them lobs a brick at my face. And I just kind of just dodge it. And my photographer buddy, Anthony Caron, kind of lifts me up by the seat of my pants and throws me under a car. So I spend the remainder of that battle taking pictures from under a car.
So this has been a long time since you first met a Nazi. Can you think back to that time? What was it like for the first couple of conversations?
When I first started this, everyone was freaked out about the Tea Party. No one was talking about the far right as any kind of force in America. So my approach was kind of like, how bizarre that these people exist, because they weren't a force. They weren't anything to seemingly be scared of. At least that's what I thought then. I remember being very taken aback by how their points of view were so plump and transparent and oftentimes moronic. They had these, the Jews rule the world conspiracy theories. things like 98% of African American kids are raised without a dad. And it's just, well, that's patently untrue. So I think I was kind of surprised at how little they knew of what was going on around them and how completely closed off they were.
You said that the views of these people that you're talking to are so narrow and sort of hard for you to understand. What kept you coming back?
I think I was looking for like an aha moment, like, oh, that's why racism exists, or why these white people seem to believe that the white race is threatened or under siege. Maybe if I just spend another weekend with these people, then I'll know, which, you know, I'm sorry to say that I kind of, there was never this eureka moment. But I felt like I needed to tell a story, and I felt like the story needed some kind of ending, and it never felt like an ending until Charlottesville, which was to me such a disgraceful, awful debacle. Maybe I don't understand it as much as I hoped I would, but if I'll ever understand it, this is as well as I will.
Did you see the intensity of the violence in Charlottesville? Did you see that coming? Did you know that was going to be that way?
No. You know, the far right loves to imagine themselves as these valiant warriors who go off to fight Antifa. They've been able to say that because it's never really happened so far. You've had, you know, Sacramento, there's been skirmishes, but these rallies have had traditionally this very clear choreography where there's two fronts and in the middle is the cops. And they create this barrier so you get to shout at the opposition and you get to say stuff like, well, if it weren't for these cops, we would get it together and I would take you. But the cops are always in the middle, at least so I thought.
And so you see Charlottesville actually as a failure of the police to do what police normally do?
Yes, absolutely. I would say that. The far-right people met at a park in the center of town, like a little square that was kind of raised. And when they all got there, there were cops there and they'd divided it into sections where there were supposed to be speeches and all that kind of stuff. And there was a few sort of forays. Some of the far-right people would go into the counter-protesters and it was a little bit of a back and forth. Then all of a sudden, I just remember that the cops left for unknown reasons, which is when things kind of really went off the rails and there was fighting in the streets. And I remember a lot of people were kind of going around shouting, where are the cops? Why aren't the cops stopping this? And I went down a block south. There was a little plaza and there were riot police fully decked out in gear, maybe a dozen or so, not doing a thing. I went up to one of the guys and said, like, there's nothing happening here, but people are, you know, being beaten bloody up in the square. Why aren't you doing anything? And he just said to leave. So I want to be clear that the violence was brought to Charlottesville by the far right, who insisted on having this hugely provocational rally there. But all the police and the authorities had to do was look at any of the dozen public rallies that had been held in the previous years to see that, you know, this is how you do it. It doesn't need to end up in violence.
Was there something that you felt the night before that suggested to you that there was actually something different also in the white supremacists that they were bringing to town, the different energy? Or
yeah. Leading up to it, they'd used the hashtag Unite the Right, and it had been pitched. That's this big, you know, we're all getting together, the boots and the suits, Heimbach, the Traditional Workers' Party, the League of the South. They're going to join forces finally with the more traditional alt-right, the Richard Spencer, Mike Enoch, those guys. So it was sold, at least to the media, as this big, you know, we're all going to have this kumbaya moment in Charlottesville. But it became clear pretty quickly to me that it was all about getting some time at the podium. And that caused a lot of friction because everyone wanted to be a headliner. There's so much ego in this movement and no one wants to play second fiddle to anyone. So from the very beginning, it was very sort of antagonistic.
So let's take a step back and say Charlottesville was billed as this unique Unite the Right rally. But in fact, you had been to, it seems like, Unite the Right events trying to bring together different groups, like every year.
Yeah.
For 4 years, 5 years.
Yeah.
Why is the right always trying to unite and why can't they?
They're trying to unite because they want to have some clout. And they've tried it for decades and decades and decades. Richard Butler, who came up with the Aryan Nations in Idaho, for a while at least, he managed to gather large swaths of the far right. Jeff Skoop tried it in the 90s. William Luther Pierce, who became famous for writing the Turner Diaries, he tried it as well. But there's always been, there's a lot of ego. Everyone wants to be the guy who brings nationalism into the mainstream in America. If everyone wants to be that guy, then no one is that guy. And it always ends up in this like stupid political infighting. They just can't work together. And there's ideological differences. You know, fundamentally, the neo-Nazis don't always agree with the KKK. You know, Richard Spencer certainly doesn't agree with the skinheads. Some groups just want to fight. You know, the Hammerskins have no political strategy other than how are we going to find the next person to beat up? So there's all these very disparate ideologies and all these like little kings of their own little personal fiefdoms. And it's just all this incessant bickering. It's very, very petty oftentimes. But we should count ourselves lucky that this is the case.
When you started doing this reporting, the neo-Nazi groups, the white supremacist groups that you're covering, are totally irrelevant politically. At what point did you start to notice them, or did they start to feel themselves on the political map?
I believe it was 2014, 2015. I went to CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Committee gathering outside of D.C., and I went with Matthew Heimbach because they were going to rally or picket it outside. It was freezing cold, and there was like three of his guys shouting these very generic nationalist nonsense at these people who ignored them. But eventually that day, me and Matthew went inside, and this guy, Donald Trump, was going to give a speech. And I remembered Matthew sitting there just completely mocking the guy, just like, this guy is a joke. It'll never be anything. We'll elect Jeb. And that'll be it. And then at some point right after that, things started changing. So I think they kind of looked at each other from across a crowded room. You know, we're saying a little bit of the same things. And so maybe you're my guy after all. And, you know, maybe we can make something happen. But I think it took them a long time to finally realize that the Donald Trump candidacy was a possibility for them.
Did any of the reporting you've seen over the past year disturb you?
When the whole hoopla around the alt-right started, you know, a couple of years ago, people seemed almost surprised that this guy is handsome or this guy is well-spoken. How can he be a racist? But racism in America isn't defined by skinheads or people who walk around with swastikas tattooed on their forehead. It's always been people with suits and people who are well-spoken. So I feel like we got it wrong when we said, oh, the alt-right is this brand new thing. The alt-right is nothing new. It's the same old ideological detritus that's been around since forever. Their opinions aren't new in any way. So I feel like we in the media, when we introduce this to this, oh, there's a new thing called the alt-right, a lot of us fail to put that into context.
There's been a huge debate over all of this neo-Nazi coverage over the past year about the different profiles of Spencer, the New York Times profile of Tony Horvater. What did you think of that New York Times story, the Nazi sympathizer next door?
I thought if you're going to cover the quote-unquote normal aspects of a white supremacist's lives, you have to make sure that you also cover the abnormal parts of his life. You have to make sure that even though he eats donuts and has a wedding registry at Pottery Barn or something like that, you have to cover the fact that he goes to rallies, he says abhorrent things online, that he is a white supremacist, that he's a white nationalist. Otherwise, you're getting it wrong. You're getting only half the story, but by telling only that half, you're getting it profoundly, profoundly wrong.
How would journalists cover the groups that you were embedded with?
For me, it was such a luxury to have the time that I had. So I don't want to badmouth a journalist who was on a tight deadline and just needed access immediately. And just, you know, they just stuck a microphone in their faces and say, why do you hate Jews?
But you saw that happen.
I saw that happen, which is a valid point. It's a good question. But if that's your opener, then you're going to get some talking points back. And I think that after a while, these guys on the far right got fairly adept at talking about these issues, at answering just kind of boilerplate questions and pivoting to, you know, well, it's not about Jews, it's about the economy and all that kind of stuff. And also, I think a lot of journalists just went into it under the assumption that these people were monsters or something, which again isn't necessarily a bad assumption to have, but it's limited in what it's going to get you in terms of interaction or engagement with these people.
What assumption did you go in under if it wasn't that they were monsters?
Well, you know, their politics certainly is monstrous, but I believe that if I engaged them under that assumption, if I just met them and said, you guys are the worst, please talk to me about why you guys are the worst, I wasn't going to get anywhere. So my MO was always like, I'll engage with them as a person to another person. You know, it's always good to report against your interest. People have asked me, how do you go reporting on these people who are so awful and who you disagree with? And my response is always like, why wouldn't I? why shouldn't we seek to understand what we find awful and abhorrent? My advice would always be to sort of to take it slow and try to approach them on a human level, because otherwise you're going to get the whole talking point spiel that they'll give to any journalist. But also be aware of your role as well, which is to be critical, to push back, and to expose the fallacies of their beliefs.
Did you become fond of any of them? Did you feel tenderness towards some of them even?
I wouldn't go that far. But, you know, I think it's in our nature, if you spend a lot of time with a person, then you find common ground. And I discuss it in my book a little bit. There's a moment where I realized that I hadn't asked Matthew questions about the Holocaust.
Wait, but that's not quite exactly. Like, you're in an IHOP with Matthew Heimbach, who is the man you followed most closely, a National Socialist. And it's how many years has it been that you've been hanging out with him at that point?
It's been, I would say, 3 years.
And it's like 3 a.m. in the IHOP in Harrisburg, and you're eating pancakes. And he says, Vegas, you've never asked me about the Holocaust.
Yeah. It took me aback. You know, I knew how he feels about Jews because he rants and raves about them the whole time. But I realized when you spend a lot of time with Klan people and skinheads, you hear a lot of awful, awful stuff. Crazy conspiracies, a lot of slurs, and it's exhausting. And Matthew doesn't speak in that way. And I realized that maybe he had become kind of like a break from the awfulness, a person I could have a normal, quote-unquote, conversation with. And I realized that maybe I hadn't asked him this question because that would pull the veil again. And so it made me kind of question, had I been doing a sufficiently good job as a journalist? Had I failed myself and my readers? It was a wake-up call. Sometimes maybe you get complacent. And obviously I asked him that question. I said, okay, I'll bite. So what do you think of the Holocaust? And I got all the misguided, horrible, you know, there's no way all these people would fit in the crematoriums, yada, yada, yada. That was kind of a reset button. It reminded me again that even though we can listen to Toto and we can talk about Dungeons and Dragons, there is this wide chasm of belief that we can never, ever cross.
The next morning, did you get up and feel like your relationship was different with him after that?
Let me be clear. Like, we were never friends, but I needed that to kind of give me a reminder of my journalistic instincts that maybe had become slightly dulled. But we've had many of those, because every time I publish something about him, he always would call me up and say that you're not really making us look good here. And I would tell him that that was never my job anyway. My response was always be like, well, this is what you said, and this is what you did. And then he would kind of mull that over a bit and say, you know, I guess you're right. Honestly, I don't know why they kept having me back.
At what point did you become afraid about the influence that the far right was having on politics?
I think, along with everyone else, I got afraid on November 9th. I was at Matthew Heimbach's house that day. We'd come from Harrisburg the day before. And we were driving around that day. It was the day of the election, and Matthew was going to go vote. We were planning on watching the returns come in that night, and I remember telling him that I was going to try not to be a jerk about Hillary winning. I was going to try to be a gracious winner about it. And I remember that needle, that New York Times had that needle of odds, and I just remember at some point it plummeted. And I just remember thinking, like, holy shit, this is real. Like, the things they've been saying to me for years is about to walk into the White House. I don't want to call Donald Trump a neo-Nazi or anything, but, you know, he ran on a platform filled with things these guys had been saying. And I remember leaving Matthew's house. I couldn't take it anymore. I couldn't even be a journalist because these guys were about to win. And I just stole his car and drove back to the hotel, jumped into bed. This was before Wisconsin had been called. And I thought, if I just go to bed and I won't find out who won, then Hillary potentially will have won it. And then at 3 a.m., I get a text message from Matthew, and he said, Wisconsin goes to Trump, everything you love will burn. Smiley face. And it hadn't really been scary until that day. And again, I'm a white male, so if you're an African American or if you're a Jewish person, then it was probably a lot scarier before that. But I always thought that, okay, you know, common sense will prevail, we'll defeat this at the ballot box.
So Trump's inauguration day, you're with Matthew Heimbach in the streets of Washington. This is 7 months before Charlottesville. Talk to me, this moment with the police, what he says to the police.
We came upon this sort of spontaneous demonstration at an intersection. I was there with Matthew and his friend Miles, and they were kind of heckling the demonstrators. And at some point, an unmarked police car, I think, came through. And Matthew was screaming to the guy, just run them over, run them over. And of course, they didn't. The people got out of the way.
Did you take him seriously when you heard that? Or how did you...
I didn't take that seriously, no. I mean, because the moment before that, they'd been singing this song to the tune of Santa Claus is coming to town. You better watch out. You better not cry. You better not pout. I'm telling you why right-wing death squad's coming to town. So I think they're kind of a little bit playing into what other people are sort of assuming about them. I don't think Matthew, at least, want right-wing death squads to go out around killing people.
Wait, why don't you think that?
He just doesn't strike me as the kind of type who would want to see people run over. Well, at least not in that instance. My take on Matthew evolved as well. He started out as this relatively pragmatic guy, and by the end of the book, he's this hardened extremist who condones the violence. So maybe he would have been okay with watching the demonstrators get run over.
You write in the book that it's not until Charlottesville that it hits you that he could really be a violent person.
Yeah.
What made you realize that he had the capacity for violence at Charlottesville?
So Matthew had always talked about how white people were literally dying. He used that all the time. They're like, we're literally dying in Appalachia from drug overdoses. The elites in New York and D.C. are literally killing us. And then Charlottesville happened, and someone quite literally lost their life. Like, someone actually died. And he was just shockingly cavalier about it. I called him up, and I said, like, why haven't you said anything about this? Why haven't you made any statement? And he said, well, I wrote something on Facebook, and the thing on Facebook was pretty much like, if you play this game, this is what's going to happen. She was an enemy combatant. So he had a very, very callous and indefensible reaction to that.
Why did you think that these Holocaust deniers would be upset if an anti-fascist died?
Maybe I was naive. I don't know. I could have been very naive, but there's always been an element of kind of war games about this. They put on their rifles and they go into the streets of Pikeville or whatever. And it's always felt like almost like live role-playing, but it didn't anymore. Heather Heyer died and no one seemed willing to take any kind of responsibility or any kind of reckoning or anything.
Matthew became famous earlier than that, though. He became famous during the Trump campaign for repeatedly shoving a black protester at a Trump rally in Louisville. And the video of this went viral because it's this young black woman, Chia Nyongkuma, who is in this crowd of white men and they're just pushing her back and forth between them. I remember showing it to two waitresses in Pikeville that Matthew had been trying to convert or telling them about it. And their reaction was just like my reaction, actually. And one of them said, you do not lay hands on a woman.
Yeah.
As a woman, a man putting his hands on you, even though shoving someone is not punching them and shoving someone is not shooting them, it's a sign for you that someone is willing to cross boundaries and is willing to be violent. And so I think they and I think I took it seriously in a way that actually, that small thing is a big red flag.
Sure, sure. It certainly gave me pause, but I don't know. Well, now that you say it that way, I guess, you know, he always had the potential of violence in him. I think to me, it also spoke about, you know, the fallacy of the ideology. He calls himself a traditionalist, right? And, you know, his job in the world is to defend women. And there he was going after women and becomes so transparent. Like, I don't mean black people. I don't mean women who disagree with me. To me, it was a sign of like, your ideology doesn't go any deeper than you're just a racist.
One of the strongest criticisms of this whole genre of reporting has been that too many of the stories are told through a white lens, and specifically a white male lens. And Jamel Bowie at Slate said that the overwhelming whiteness of American political reporting was a real impediment to understanding how dangerous these groups are.
I think that's absolutely true. I mean, you brought up a good example. Maybe I didn't see the awfulness of Matthew shoving this woman because I'm not the traditional victim of far-right nationalism. Like, I'm not a victim of racism. I'm not a victim of discrimination. So this beat would benefit from having someone who is the victim of it, who feels that daily. I always think that as many perspectives as possible would be essential, and not just on this particular topic, but all topics. But, you know, all we can do is try to be as critical as we can be, try to push back. You know, I don't have to be a Jewish person to be able to push back against the wildly anti-Semitic things they say. I don't have to be a woman or an African-American to be able to sort of stay critical. So I've always tried to push back. But another person's experience isn't my experience, and we would all benefit from that, I think.
And did you find yourself, when you weren't around the Nazis, acting in a different way, or did it sort of ripple out into your life when you're a sort of white man alone without a Nazi next to you, that you saw things differently? Or
I think it gave me the ability to recognize a lot of sort of white nationalist dog whistling, because I recognize a lot of the rhetoric you see in politics today as something I've heard before. Representative Steve King of Iowa has a tendency to tweet out wildly crazy racist stuff. And I'm like, oh, okay, someone told me that at a rally 7 years ago. I remember a talk I'd had with Jeff Scoop, the commander of the National Socialist Movement, the first time I met him back in Trenton, New Jersey in 2011. He was telling me that the far right movement, the nationalist movement in America, needs to run for elections. And I said, well, how are you guys ever going to get elected saying the things you say, believing the things they do? The American people will never accept it. And he just told me something like, the American people will accept a candidate with these views if he appeals to people's fear, to a sense of aggrievement. At the time, I thought, like, this is crazy. But Jeff Scoop was right 7 years ago. And I think that's the danger they represent. Even though the Klan or the neo-Nazis aren't strong, their words are being used by people who are.
I have to say, as a journalist reading your book, which is really beautifully written and vivid and engaging, by the end of it, I thought, covering these groups is a waste of time. You describe them as sort of like a herd of racist cats, that almost every rally you went to except Charlottesville was like a couple dozen people. They were fighting over costumes, that most of these people were absurd. And your conclusion after 6 years of covering these groups is that they're not going to succeed. So does it make sense actually for journalists to be covering these groups? Is this a movement that journalists should be taking seriously?
Yes, of course we should cover these people, because it informs so much of, sadly, our current president's way of thinking. But again, we need to put it into context. The Klan will put some flyers on some cars in a parking lot in Raleigh, North Carolina, and all of a sudden, like, all the journalists go there to cover the Klan. And, you know, that's well and good. If the Klan is marching in the street, we should talk about it. But we need to talk about the bigger issue, about how what they say and what they believe has made its way into the mainstream. We need to put it into a context. We can't just sort of fearmonger that, oh, the Klan is marching again. Yes, they are, but, you know, we also have this more potent form of nationalism that's we somehow elected into office. But if you just go and cover a Richard Spencer speech, then what have you really learned? And I would say not a lot.
You write in your book, after spending 6 years with the boots on the ground of white supremacy, that the far right in America, at least the incarnation I spent years covering, is destined to fail, but that white supremacy is doing just fine without the far right. What did you mean by that?
Again, you just have to look at the world we live in to see that it's dominated by the interest of white people, white males. Look at the prison system. Look at the rate we're incarcerating people of color. Look at the way we keep minorities in poverty. Look at the system is perfectly rigged to benefit white people. So that's why I think this kind of plump, very open form of nationalism and white supremacy isn't going to work, because there's no need for it. White supremacy is doing well without it.
Vegas, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Vegas Tenold is a journalist and author of Everything You Love Will Burn. Lois Beckett is a senior reporter for The Guardian U.S. and was the host of our special hour on covering racism and the far right in America. To hear that show, go to onthemedia.org. And while you're there, check out the special quizzes we made that delve further into the sticky issues discussed in this hour. And while you're at it, sign up for our newsletter. I mean, why not?